afternoon. Thanks for coming back and listen so soon. Bring in the stories of everyday folks while you sit back, relax, have a whisk, coach. Here we go with the Trend Speak podcast, bringing you insight or bringing a laugh. Here's the man who might have a plan. Give it up for your host, Trent Pod Scaland.
Happy belated Mother's Day to all the mothers out there, whether it's your own mother or maybe a mother figure or role model in your life. I hope you all had a fantastic weekend, and I'm not going to spend a whole lot of time talking, both now and you'll notice in the actual interview itself this week. I've got a great lineup of guests to bring you over the next few weeks, next few months here. And I couldn't be happier to start with these two gentlemen that I'm going to let you listen in on today. I'll toss it over to myself to introduce them shortly here, but we had such a good conversation. These guys talked for, we were supposed to talk for about 45 minutes is what I had scheduled. We ended up talking for about just over an hour and a half. So I did break this one up into two separate parts, so notice that you will hear part of the episode this week, and I will premiere the other part of the episode next Monday, so be sure to tune back in for part two. Without further ado, here is Jared and Sammy. Cool, there we go, we're recording. So, Jared, Sammy, welcome into the podcast. Let's just dive right back in because Jared had started talking and I was like, Jared, we haven't even hit record yet. Jared and Sammy were in a band, are in a band. I'll let you guys talk a lot about the band and everything. But I'm going to turn it over to you guys so that you can kind of talk about what it is that we wanted to chit chat about today.
Yeah. And I think before we talk about Joe, I wanted to talk about one of his teachers. His name was, we called him Smokey. His name was David Miller. He was kind of a local legend in Bay City where we all kind of came up. And he's been around since like the 70s. And people would find him playing the guitar at the mall and in the music store. And he'd just be shredding, playing some Rush song or something. And he was in almost every single garage band in town. And there were all these photos of him at barbecues or whatever, which is a very Bay City kind of thing. And he was just always there in the corner with his head a little bit down, playing the guitar, eyes closed. That was his thing. He was kind of a quiet guy. He kept to himself, but he was incredibly friendly. On his way home from like the grocery store, he'd just stop and say hello to people. So everyone knew who this guy was. And people were just blown away by his talent. He knew like the whole staff of Indian Berries, which was like this biker bar slash kind of venue that even we used to play at. But yeah, he was just like a really kind of quiet, humble, chill guy. But there's this story that I heard of his, where a friend of his, Tim was his name. They were watching some Malmsteen videos, or what is it? Malmsteen. He's a sweet.
Yngwie Malmsteen.
Oh, but say it again. Just say it again.
Yngwie
Malmsteen. So he's this insane Swedish guitarist, and he has this song called Arpeggios from Hell. And it really, it's an intense video. And Smokey and his friend are watching this, and Smokey just kind of has this sinister look on his face. And then he turns to his buddy and he chuckles and he just says, "We ought to break his fingers," which is just like, it's something, it's very that same flavor of weirdness that that our friend Joe definitely was. He was a real chill guy, but he was a goofball.
Not your average Joe.
He was not your average Joe. Not at all. But yeah, take it away, Sammy.
So prior to Smokey, there was a band that played around Bay City, the surrounding areas. Before I begin, it's very easy, and it was, I don't want to say it was easy, but at that time there was a thriving music scene in the mid Michigan area. And, you could become a very big fish in a small pond. And, there was a band called Born, and their guitar player's name was John. And, you know, back when Joe first started showing interest in the guitar, he started taking lessons from John. And, you know, everybody just kind of idolized this band. Born, they were very Tool-esque. That was the kind of music that we listened to. And Joe was taking lessons from him, and just absolute natural talent. And he always wanted to add so much more to the chord or to the scale. Or, you know, he would come with all these quirky, crazy ideas. And that was just Joe. And finally got to a point where John said, you know, I can't teach you anything. You need to start teaching me some things, you know. So that's kind of the prequel to Joe seeking out Smokey. And obviously Smokey had just crazy, crazy talent. And he was unique. Joe became this very, very unique musician. I think it just changed his perspective and even just the music that he was listening to at the time. So that was kind of prior to me meeting Joe. And by the time I met him, I was already absolutely blown away. Such a amazing individual. You wouldn't forget him.
Joe was probably we were like late teens, early 20s when I came around, and Joe already at that point was just prodigy status. I mean, he was on another level. I have never seen someone play guitar like that guy. It was just so wild. He would do things that I had never, ever, ever seen before. And the first time I heard you guys play, I was freaking out. I didn't know what to do. So, yeah.
So, I mean, before we get into all that, I gotta tell everybody first how I met Joe.
Yes.
And then how I met Jared and just how everything kind of came together. Sophomore year of high school, Joe had a reputation. I didn't know him for his music. I knew him for other extracurricular things that, you know, he was doing. And he was very popular. him and Cody had him in science class, and Joe always would ask questions. He would always challenge authority. He was one of those guys. And I always admired that about him, but we'd be, you know, I had two classes with him, science class. Miss Pop was her name. Apparently Joe and Miss Pop had some sort of a history, and I used to be so entertained. I knew that I wanted to be friends with this guy because, you know, she'd be teaching and giving a lecture, and he would raise his hand and say, "I disagree, Miss Pop." And she'd turn around so frustrated and say, "Okay, Joe, you know, let's hear your explanation." And he was so, he was odd. You know, he was intelligent, very, very intelligent guy, but he thought way outside the box. And he would give some random out there explanation as to what he thought, how he interpreted what she was saying. And the whole class would laugh. And then she would just look at him every time and say, "You know what? Smoke another one, Joe. Just go ahead, smoke another one." And I think, I don't know if he did that on purpose. He didn't chuckle even. He was sometimes very serious and passionate about the things that he was arguing about. And I knew that I wanted to be friends with this guy. We had another class together. It was broadcasting. And I didn't really skip school before I met Joe. Let's just put that out there. One day we're heading to broadcasting, and I caught him in the hallway, and he just looks at me and he says, "You want to get out of here?" And I said, you mean skip broadcasting? He's like, "Yeah, yeah." He's like, "You know, we'll go to the internet cafe. We'll burn one down. And then we'll go to Mid-Michigan Music. There's this guitar I really want to check out. And there's this guy there I'll introduce you to." We go to the internet cafe, do exactly that. And then we're cruising. It's probably a half mile or so walk to the music shop. We get stopped by the cops, right? And I'm like, "Oh shit," you know. They're like, "Aren't you guys supposed to be in school?" And Joe just kind of looked at me and he said, "You know, I got this, don't worry about it." You know, and he just very nonchalantly said, "Oh, you know, me and this guy here, we're heading back to the career center. We're just on a break right now, and we got a We'll get back. He started naming names of people at this career center. Apparently his story checked out to this police officer, because then we were on our way to the music store and I was like, man, I really like this guy, you know? So I got to hear him play. It was really incredible. I had another class with, her name was Sam Lee Wendowski. She was Cody DeShano, our bass player, his girlfriend. And she's kind of the one that hooked us up musically. They found out I was a drummer. They needed a drummer. Cody and Joe had been playing together for quite some time. I had no frame of reference. All I knew was, you know, they sold drugs and they hung out with the drug crowd and they were very popular in that realm. And I was definitely not in that world. So this was something that was totally different for me. But I had a drum set in my bedroom at my mother's house on the south end of Bay City. And, you know, I had people over to jam every once in a while, but a lot of times it was just me. And here comes rolling in these guys that looked straight out of Dazed and Confused. Cody didn't say two words to me the whole time. Not the whole time, but walked right past me. So they set up. We didn't speak. And this is something that we always kind of talked about, you know, like before we had a conversation, we struck a chord, right? You know, but they set up and we just played. They looked at me. I don't even think they asked me to drop some sort of a beat. They just looked at me. And I said, oh, I guess that's my cue. And we ended up playing for hours. And just, we didn't talk. We just played. We just played. And some of those early Fracas tunes, you know, kind of formed from that. And then it was a couple times a week, you know, just playing and playing and playing and playing. And so, Jared, before we get into the music, talk about how you came to Bay City, how you stumbled upon me.
Yeah, no, you know what? It's all, Bay City has so many music stores. So many things happen in music stores. Just like Sam ran away to a music store to, like, you know, skip class, and Smokey was always there shredding or whatever. So, I mean, okay, I grew up in Southern California, and for someone growing up in Southern California to find themselves in Bay City, Michigan, it's not because things are, like, going according to plan. I'll keep it short and sweet like that. So I'm kind of there just like, what the hell am I doing in Bay City, Michigan? This place is crazy. And I had been kind of interested in music a little bit. I really loved songwriting. I really loved just kind of composing and whatever. I really enjoyed that aspect of music, but I never really considered myself like an accomplished musician. And I had just finished, I auditioned for this band. They were called Lemon Party. I feel like I can drop their name because they don't exist anymore, but they were just very, like, they were in such a bad mood, like, the whole time. And I remember just hating the whole process and being like, if this is what music is, I don't want anything to do with music, because they seem so unhappy. And all they were talking about was like, is this something that's marketable? Is this something that, you know, we have some producer in Nashville, but we have to make sure that we, like, fit his mold and all. It was so, like, bad, and it wasn't my gig at all. So I'm kind of blowing off steam at the music store, and I'm going from, like, one guitar to the next, trying to figure out one that really, like, suits me. And I see this ad, and it was, like, the most strangely worded ad I had ever seen. It made very little sense. It was just kind of like, we're a funky band. If you're a singer, come and, like, you know, check us out. So I do. I call these guys up and I show up, and I remember, I think it was either you, Sam, or Joe who said, oh, I thought you were a woman. When I was walking up, you're like, oh, I thought you were a chick. Okay, we're off to a good start. That's cool. But it's very similar to what you said, where I get up to upstairs in your house, the fire alarm is, like, beeping. You know how when you need to change a battery, it's, like, beeping. And I remember just this beeping, like, over and over and over while we're sitting there, like, tuning and everything. And I'm just getting more and more nervous. But they all just look at each other and they just start playing. And that was it. And they're just playing. And I just was like, okay, I guess I'm singing. So I start singing. And I think we sang like, we went through two songs. I sang two songs and just like made vowel sounds. And they all just look at each other and they go, all right. And that was really it. That was the decision. You were just like, yep, he's in. And then we just kept playing. And I want to say we played for maybe like 2 or 3 hours after that. And I just went on and on. But I remember during that time being so like flabbergasted by your guys' talent and being like, man, I really have to kind of up my game. So I went home that night and I was like, I have to write like the song. And I went through just all the poetry I've ever written and anything that I've ever like any thought I've ever had. I just kind of like pieced it all together. And I was just like, okay, I have to write the coolest song I've ever written. And I came back and I wrote this song called Mars Attacks Mind. And I remember when I first sang it for you guys, it was to a song that they already had written, but they didn't have lyrics to. And I remember when I sang it, you guys were just like, wow, that's cool. And to me, that was the greatest feeling I have ever felt in my entire life. Cause I was like, you have to understand, like I was this like nerdy kid. I was so friggin' weird. And these guys were cool. Like these guys were just like Cody and Joe, super chill. Sam, like so friendly and just so like charismatic. And I'm sitting here like, they're going to figure out that I'm a freak and they're going to not know what to do. I remember thinking that the whole time, like the gig is going to be up at some point, but they would like come over to my house and I'd make you nasty, weird pasta that you ate and like you would just jam out. And it was just, it was wild how we would just chill. And so quickly we became like inseparable. We spent so much time together.
It's and I always thought it was so funny that Jared thought that he was weird because, you know,
you were weird.
We were weird.
Yeah.
I mean, all of us were weird. And anyways, so I instantly liked Jared, you know, regardless if he was in the band or not, I knew that we were going to be friends.
Yeah.
You know, I thought he was funny and I got a pretty weird sense of humor. And, just all of us in general, you know, Cody was kind of grumpy, but Joe was had that quirky side to him. And, you know, how organic everything came together, despite our differences, it made for this really cool sound. It made for this really amazing sound, something that was different, you know, and there were so many bands at that time. In Bay City, there's more bars and churches per capita than I think any city I've ever seen. So, I mean, there's always music. There's always something going on. And there's always like that kind of same old bar band, right? But we were something a little bit different. We were playing funky music, but it was original. It would be like mixing Red Hot Chili Peppers with Primus and then adding like live on top of it, you know? So it had a grunge aspect to it. It had a funk aspect to it, had a rock and roll aspect to it. And, you know, we were able to kind of hone in on our own sound, which was really exciting. So the fact that we didn't talk about this idea or, you know, huddle up and say, this is what we want to do. We just did it, you know, and I think that's what made it so special and exciting. And, you know, we were inseparable. We were so excited to have this thing, have this band, have this camaraderie. And, you know, we started playing shows. Some of those first shows were kind of rough. So
wait, can I say something here before you go on? There was one show at Indian Berries that I will always remember forever. There was this girl, this redheaded girl, who started dancing in front of the stage. And I remember she was dancing with her hand on her face. And she was freaking out. And I remember she came up on stage and she's dancing on me. There's photos of this. There's videos of this. And she turns and she whispers in my ear and she says, I bet you can F better than a goat. And I will always remember that. But we always, the man who tried to give you a quarter or like asked for your phone number, like while you were on stage, that was like, we had so many odd things happen while we were performing.
Yeah. But, yeah, the goat thing. I got, you know, being the drummer, sometimes you just get to sit back and laugh. I mean, I've got some stories though, where I was the person getting picked on. I mean, there was that one show where that guy hopped up on stage and knocked over my cymbal to hand me his number on a napkin right in the mid-set. Kind of wild. But, you know, previous to meeting Jared, we played. We had a friend named Jordan Westfall who also passed away. And he was singing for us. Not the most accomplished vocalist, but our first gig was with him, and some of the first stuff that we did was with him, but we needed a real singer. And you know, I think after some of the failed attempts, you know, Jared actually having a really awesome unique voice, we were like, yeah, that's the guy for sure. And then his personality on top of that just added to it. He's very fantastic front man. You know, so it worked really well. And I remember Joe at first, so talented, but when we would play live, he was so shy. There were times where he would set his pedal boards up facing away from the audience. he wanted to play, but he wanted to be off in the corner somewhere. And then Cody hadn't really come into his own. Also very, very talented guy, you know, having influences like Victor Wooten and Les Claypool and things like that. And Joe having influences like, you know, Jimmy Page and Hendrix and, you know, all those really great guitar players that were so innovative. He wanted to be different. You know, Joe, when he would write a song, first of all, the picks that he used were they were thick. They were almost like a bass pick. It was ridiculous. It was like he wanted the thickest pick that he could possibly play because he struck the strings really, really hard. He put feeling into those notes. He mixed major and minor scales. He went off on tangents, you know. I mean, the stuff that he wrote was just downright cool. I mean, if you're into experimental music, I mean, he was your guy, and it's the way his brain worked. I absolutely loved it. And what was so cool about Joe is he challenged you as a musician. He challenged you because, you know, there were certain songs like Jared, you can attest to this. There were certain songs he would come at us with, you know, and Jared would be like, how am I going to put lyrics to that?
Oh,
you know?
Yeah.
And he would. But
no, there were times where I would approach him. I mean, like we wrote songs a lot together, and I would come to him with an idea and I'd strum it on my guitar, and he would be like, oh, cool. And he would, you know, Joe-ify it is always what I would say, where he would take like a chord progression and then just go off the deep end with it. And it would reach the point where like the lyrics I had in mind and the melody and whatever didn't really fit anymore because he like changed it into some different scale and all this other stuff. But it sounded so cool. I couldn't like poo-poo it because it was way cooler than my idea. You know, I was just banging out chords. But that was always the challenge with Joe, was like trying to just stay at his level and like meet him where he's at, wherever he goes, because there were always so many strange things. I remember we were trying to learn a cover of South Side of the Sky by Yes, which is Yes is like my favorite band of all time. I love them so much. And when they agreed to cover a song of theirs, I know John Anderson, when he's on stage, all he does is point at the sky. It's weird that you know that, but he's so weird. John Anderson is also really weird. I love that guy. He's so freaking strange, but he wears like robes on stage. Anyway, I give them the tab for Southside, and they're learning it. And then like Joe kind of like fudges apart, or like Cody fudges apart. And then they're like, wait a minute. And they just start jamming off the mistake that they make. And that's how we wrote one of our songs, Momentum, was it was literally us screwing up a cover and it turned into an entirely different song. So it's just that, like, our creative process was so untamed and insane. It was really hard to chase it because it was just constant, like, oh, now we're going in this direction. Now we're going in this direction. But we made it work for sure. But it was madness. Our songwriting process was madness.
I want to say that we never did a bad cover, but we never did a correct cover.
No, never.
I don't think ever, not once. I think that we had, you know, they got the idea, but we always made it our own. And so sorry to the artists that we covered, or if that offends them, you know, it was great at the time. Maybe even some of them improved.
I can't say that.
Anyway,
we made it our own though, for sure. Is this really a time cap I'm seeing, by the way? I see like 9 minutes.
Yeah, I just saw that too, and I didn't know that was a thing.
That's okay.
So don't worry about the time cap. If it ends, I can always send a new link. That must be a new thing with Zoom, because I don't remember having a time cap on here before.
All right. I'll try not to just like...
Oh, you're fine. Don't worry about the time.
Okay. But yeah, I guess, you know, our songwriting process was so crazy. And I remember... I feel like... Wait. There's still so much more that we have to cover, like our Battle of the Bands. So I remember... When we were in Michigan... this was the first, like, I am not a competitive person, but if I'm going to compete, like, I'm going to compete, you know? And with all the guys I knew, like, especially like Sam, you mentioned, when Joe plays, he just closes his eyes and he just kind of does his thing. And he's very, like, he just goes inside of himself. I was like, all right, I got to freak out. Like, that's just what I got to do. So I remember I like stood on a stool and I like jumped around and I was going insane. All right. And like, we all killed it. I feel like that was one of the best shows we ever did. We were just on another level. And I remember at the end when they announced the winner, the announcer was just like, the winner's obvious, you guys, like there could only be one. And we won. And what we won was studio time. And the studio time was meant for just like one track. You know, you get a day of recording to kind of, you know, do whatever you need to like get a song out there. But we, being us and being out of our minds, decided that what we're going to do is record a whole album in one take. And we did it, by the way.
Oh my
But we
gosh.
Practiced and practiced and practiced and practiced, and we recorded our whole album in one take. And even Jordan showed up high on coke.
I'll never forget. You know, I wish...
Dude, I love that guy so much.
He was such a great guy. This is when you wish that you could just, like... plug something into your brain and record a memory.
Yeah.
That Shamrock Showdown Battle of the Bands that we got into was so cool. I mean, it was at a Masonic temple.
Yeah.
So we have a Masonic temple in Bay City. It's got a bunch of hidden rooms in it. But anyways, this place was full. The bands that we were competing against were really good. You know, there was like a panel of judges. The radio station, Z93 was there. And I remember I had these glowing drumsticks. My grandmother had bought them for me. And they glowed blue because we had a song called Rapture, in which at the end there was a big drum solo. And, you know, I was able to turn on these glowing drumsticks and do my drum solo. And we just gave it, we left everything on the stage. And afterwards, when we found out we won and we won the studio time, we were like, man, you know, we got to make the absolute most of this. I mean, none of us had any money. You remember how poor we were, Jared?
Oh, we had nothing. We had nothing. Money. Yeah, we were broke as hell.
So we were like, we gotta make the absolute most of this. And so we crushed every rehearsal to try and make sure that we didn't have to... that we were able to just go song after song after song after song and just make it happen. We recorded an entire album. And I remember we were sweaty and just like excited and just that whole feeling. And then, you know, we had a hidden track on there. We did this song called The Bum Song, which is a song, I don't know what to say. We wrote, there's a lot of bums in Bay City, a lot of homeless people. And we wrote a song about a bum and it was real funky. And Jordan came in just high out of his mind, wearing no shirt and no shoes.
Yep.
Hopped on the microphone and one take. That's all we got. One take. But the album Funk Rock Us, Jared did all the artwork for it. Had my buddy Stan draw little cartoons of us, and you'll see that on the back of the album. But Jared had put together this really, really cool look kind of logo that stuck with us for a while. It was a spaceman holding a lighter.
Yeah.
And
I also, by the way, I mixed and mastered that thing.
He did.
That was a
feat. I think that's how we got to do it all in one take, because we would have run over, but we took from some of the mixing and mastering, because we were gonna, I think we won mixing and mastering, but you ended up doing
that. Like all of it. He did a little bit. I remember he did a little bit. He helped me out.
Yeah.
But yeah, most of it was in our place, because at this time, Sam and I, we were living together. We were at his mom's place, and I remember you would come into the room and be like, "Hey Sam, listen to this. Does this sound good?" And you'd be like, "Yeah." I'd be like, "All right, cool. I'm doing the right thing." And that was that. Sam was like, it was him and your brother, Mike, you would just kind of wander, because my room had no door. So someone would just like walk by. This is how poor we were. We had nothing. We didn't even have doors on our bedrooms. But someone would walk by. I used to
write messages on his wall by his bed. I'd write him little notes on the wall.
Yeah. we never ever put a battery in that alarm, by the way. It drove me crazy. Someone would just walk by my room and I'd be like, "Hey, come in here." And I'd be like, "Listen to this. Is this good or is this bad? Tell me the truth." And everyone would be like, "Yeah, this is cool." So that was how the album was made. It was actually a lot of fun.
I mean, I still pull that out and listen to it and think, wow, it's such a blast from the past, because, everything started rolling along after that. We had a big CD release party. We were gaining some momentum in the mid-Michigan area. We were becoming a big fish in a small pond, we started bringing 50 people to a show. Then, we started bringing 100 people to a show. And then, we'd go play an entire skating rink, where they would shut down the skating rink and they'd set up a stage and we'd fill the skating rink. Started playing the bigger venues in Bay City. If something was going on, we were a part of it, we started gaining this following, and it was really, really cool. We felt like we were on the right track. And then Jared got a job opportunity, out in Colorado.
Yeah.
And I remember he approached me first about it, and he said, "Hey, I'm taking this, position out in Colorado. Who's coming with me? Are you going to come with me? We can make this thing happen." And I was like, I'm not going to get into this too much, but I was going through a really, really rough time. Had a lot of just personal things that I was ready to hop in a van and run away, at that time. And if it was with my friends, great, that would be perfect. So I was like, I'm totally in. And so I have to convince Cody, and we called him Indecisive Cody.
His catchphrase was, "I don't know, guys. I don't know. That was his catchphrase.
"I don't know, guys." But so Joe he was having problems. His girlfriend had just broken up with him. And I remember him saying, "Yeah, let's do it." Then it took all of us to kind of coax Cody, who was also having girlfriend problems at the time. Everybody was having girlfriend problems at the time, besides Jared, I think. But anyways, we went down to the river when we used to hang out on the train bridge all the time and just talk about life. We'd bring a bottle of Castillo because that's all we could afford. Little sipping spiced rum in a plastic bottle. Yeah. delicious. But anyways, we talked about it and we wanted to make a go of this thing. So Cody bought very cheaply this motorcycle trailer from his buddy. We spray painted Frockus on the side of it. That was the name of our band, Punk Rock Us, all into one word, Frokus. And loaded up everything. I had $200, a pack of cigarettes, a trash bag full of clothes, and a futon mattress. Not even the whole futon, just the mattress. And I remember we didn't take much. Jared had already headed out, and we said goodbye, and we broke down about halfway through. Had to stop and get our big van. It was one of those vans that had like a magazine rack and curtains and folded out into a bed. I call her Betsy. She was ugly, but she got the job done. You know, we had no money for a hotel, so we ended up parking. We had just crossed the Mississippi River, and we just parked and slept. And then when I woke up, I'll never forget this, because I wanted to change my clothes. And I figured we were just in a parking lot. Well, apparently it was some sort of tourist destination. And I step out of the van, and there's a ton of Asian people taking pictures. And one person turned around and took a picture of me. And I was like, what is going on here? It was just kind of awkward. But we got back in the van, and we headed out. We had made a kind of a playlist, a really giant playlist. And we were just jamming like the whole way there. And I'll never forget this, like as long as I live. It was so perfect, because we arrived in Denver, and you know, we're just kind of looking at the landscape, and you know, you can obviously see the beautiful mountains in the background, and that song by Fatboy Slim came on. You know, we've come a long, long way together, you know, and I was like, wow, you know, this is so perfect. And I just remember us getting really, really excited. We met Jared in Aurora at this town home that he had acquired. And
we're acquired.
I was like, this is way too nice. I was like, this is gonna be
it great. Wasn't that nice, man.
We destroyed it. It was nice.
We did destroy it.
It still smells like beer, actually, to this day. I'm sure.
It was nice. It was nicer than probably any place that we've ever been together. But we all lived in this place together. It was this 4-bedroom townhome. Joe was down in the basement in this little cave. And we set up our jam room right outside of his room. And I remember we would play every night in there and just go for hours and hours and hours. The neighbors didn't complain. They loved it.
Didn't say nothing.
It was wild. But, you know, I remember lying in bed. It was just this like crappy foam mattress on the floor. Because I had just gotten this new job, and finally, like, we have some coin for something, you know, and I'm lying in bed alone. I don't know, by the way, this is like before we had legitimate cell phones. I don't think we could have afforded cell phones at that time. So I was just hoping they'd show up. I had no idea what time or even what day they'd be there. But I remember lying in bed and hearing the door open, and I knew it was Cody by his like footsteps. And he came to my room and he just gave me the biggest hug. And I just thought that was so insane that you guys were finally here. Because a big part of me believed that I was being punked. And I was like, all right, if these guys don't show up in like a few more days, I'm going to have to find some roommates.
we had some challenges, you know,
yeah,
on the way.
Because they were late. So I was extra freaking out at that point. So
definitely. So we didn't have any furniture. How long did we go without furniture? I remember.
Well, we lived across the street from a thrift store, which served us very, very well.
That's
helpful. A lot of the
clothes
that I wore on stage were from there. A lot of the furniture in our house was from there. Our cookware, our plates, and a lot of things. If it wasn't for that thrift store, I would have still been on that mattress on the floor.
I bought a pair of corduroy pants from that thrift store that I used to like to perform with. But Jumping ahead a little bit, we set up shop. I'm gonna tell this story just because it's funny. We hadn't been there very long, and we didn't have any furniture, so we were sitting on the floor playing cards. Jared, you were at work or something. I don't think I had a job yet. Anyways, we're sitting on the floor playing cards. Joe is he was ADD for sure. I mean, the guy couldn't sit still. And me and Cody, I think we were all playing poker, but Joe couldn't sit. So he would wanted to walk around and then he'd play his cards, which I don't know how that worked. But anyways, he's walking around and all of a sudden he just starts picking on Cody and he's like, and he would like do it in his ear. And you just see Cody getting really, really frustrated, right? And then so he keeps doing it. Then Joe goes outside to smoke a cigarette and there's out on the patio, it's like a sliding glass door. And every 2 minutes, he, you know, and he was like directing this towards Cody. Then he started calling him obscenities along with the weird, weird noise he was making. Cody goes and he sits in the kitchen on the counter because he just kind of wants to separate himself. And I'll never forget this. I'm still on the floor and I'm looking at these two. And I see Cody, his ears are turning red and then his face starts turning red. And, you know, he's just kind of looking like, you know, if he says this one more time. Well, on the patio, there was a wooden fence, about a 6-foot wooden fence. And there was a gate there leading out to the lawn area out in the front of these townhomes. And then there's a big main road, Mississippi Avenue, very, very busy street. So he does it again. You know, Cody jumps up off the counter, rushes out, grabs him up by his shirt, throws him through the fence. And here's Joe tumbling down towards Mississippi Avenue. And I'm just like, this is just great. You know, but I mean, it was also entertaining because I didn't have anything else to do at the time. And then, of course, Joe's like, I'm going home. I quit. And Cody's just like, shut up. You're not going home. You don't have enough money to go home. None of us have any money. We should probably go find a job. And I'll never forget that time because we walked everywhere. Just like that was a time of paper applications, right? So we walked everywhere. You know, I wasn't used to the dry desert climate. So I got this giant sunburn on my forehead that scabbed over. And yeah, it was great going to interviews looking like that. But anyways, just wanted to tell that story. You know, fresh off the boat, you know, Cody's throwing Joe right through the fence.
You guys fought a lot and I would always cry. That was my defense. That's true. You guys would beat each other up and I just start bawling and either you would stop or you get mad at me. But like, well, I was the mother of the house. I have to like, I'd be mad because like people weren't cleaning. People weren't respecting their bedtimes. I was just like I was such a staunch old lady. But I loved y'all, but I was always just like, hey, come on, you guys. Like we need to clean these plates before they get in the dishwasher, you know? So, but I don't even think half of you even had a dishwasher up until that point. But nope. I mean, yeah, we were all so broke. But you know, we moved to Denver, not only because I got a job opportunity there, but because at the time, like 303 had come out, The Fray, and there was a band like Paper Birds was just starting to like become a thing. So I'm thinking, okay, if we get to Denver, there is this huge scene right now where all these bands are getting discovered. We got to hop aboard that train because there is really no industry people in Bay City. So we're thinking like, this is where we're going to go to really make a name for ourselves and become somebody. But the problem was that we were all kids and we had no clue what we were doing. And I think it showed in the fact that like, we really couldn't figure out how to do like anything. I mean, we got shows, we got gigs and we played places and we had people who really enjoyed our music. We had kind of a small following, but it was a lot harder than I think we anticipated it would be. Because in Bay City, you know, 3 out of 4 of us had already a giant group of friends who knew who we were and would talk to everyone about it and be like, hey, did you know that Joe and Cody and Sam, they're in a band now? You know, I had people who I knew who would talk about it. There, we were all these kind of like nobody strangers who nobody cared about. So trying to make a name for yourself in some town where nobody knows you is pretty difficult. Go for it.
I remember Jared borrowing your laptop. We didn't have like Wi-Fi or internet or anything. So I would sit in this very special spot out on the patio where I could steal Wi-Fi from one of the neighbors. And I used to make up these emails and just search for any venue. And we're talking 50 at a time. And I would just send out mass emails and whatever time slot. You know, this is the special thing about this band. We just wanted to play. So there were times where they'd say, okay, you know, come out and play and, you know, bring a 3-hour set. And we had like an hour and a half, right? You know, a solid hour and a half. And we would just make things up, you know, for the rest of the time. And it was absolutely crazy. And Jared had this notebook, you know, full of ideas. And, you know, we would just kind of, we would jam, you know, and in a sense, we had structure to what we did. But at the same time, you know, some of our shows were almost like band practice to us.
That's what it became. Yeah. Like the shows that weren't big shows that didn't have an audience, there were so many times where we were playing to a salad buffet, you know, to like two people in a basement or something. And I have to admit at the time, like I grew up, I watched like Hedwig and the Angry Inch like every night. So for me, that was somebody who like they, you know, if you've never seen the movie, like they're playing literally like Red Lobsters across the country. And that was really how I felt. We had gigs where we were like maybe two or three people were in the audience. And yeah, we treated it like band practice. And then we'd come home and we'd play. That was like all we ever did. That was all we really knew. And even when I was at work, you know, and by the way, that laptop that Sammy, you would borrow, I stole from work because I was an electronics repair guy. And it was like that, that Johnny Cash song where it was piece by piece. I would just take like one piece of a laptop home at a time. I remember spray painting it black. So it'd be like cool. And I put it all together. And that was like my little, you know, my little Chevy that was like 6 years apart, you know, but, yeah, I mean, it was just, I don't know. It was wild how much we played and we never really got sick of it. All we were doing was singing. And I mean, like, I remember I'd go to the bank and I'd start singing in line and people would like stop and be like, wow, like, are you in a band or anything? And I was like, yeah, you should come see our show. You know, like it was always something we were doing. And Sam, like you would meet people and just, Sam is so charismatic. And I mean, he can charm the pants off of anybody. And he would meet people in the most random places and they would wind up at our shows too. So, but still we really struggled to get a good audience. It was really hard there. We were always scheming, but we were always getting bamboozled was the thing. We were all like, we got booked for a festival, South Park Music Festival. And we wound up just in the middle of the woods in the middle of the night watching, like we stopped, we were out in the middle of the mountains, out in the middle of nowhere. And we went down the wrong road because we couldn't figure out where we were going. And all of a sudden we noticed that there's all these like animal carcasses strung up around the road. And that's when Cody decides to stop. And Joe like wants to get out of the car.
What did Joe say? Joe said, I got to take a piss. And I'm like,
I know. We're like, Joe, no, not right now. But we had a really hard time finding, advantageous situations. I don't know. We had this scheming shitty manager who was just an awful garbage can of a human being. But I don't know.
He stole like a lot of money from us too. Because when we started making money, you know, the thing about this individual was he could get us shows and the people came to the shows, but he took all the money. So when we started making money that could have really furthered what we were trying to do, he took it all. And
yeah,
so we kind of we had to start over a few different times. And what we needed was direction. We had, you know, the music, we had the drive. We just, we had no idea how to break into the music business. So we made a lot of mistakes, and you know, we had a wild ride. Like he mentioned that South Park Music Festival thing. I'll never forget. After that, we went and we parked. There was no vacancy in this town. And I walked into the hotel and I laid down on the couch in the lobby. And then I found out they don't let you do that. So we went and parked by this bar. And I'll never forget this. It was just so funny. So Jared was in the passenger seat. Cody was in the driver's seat. I was like off to the side in this van. And Joe was laying on the floor underneath of the seats that were laid back all the way. And Cody had turned his head and he was facing down, like kind of towards Joe, and Joe was stuck. And this is how weird Joe was, you know, like he was stuck down there. He couldn't move. And he didn't say anything. He just waited patiently for somebody to wake up. And so him and Cody their faces are probably about 6 inches apart, and Cody opens his eyes and Joe's just looking at him. Hey, you want to let me up, man? And he goes, ah!
Cody, so I remember waking up to Cody screaming in terror because Joe was just standing there staring at him, or laying there staring at him. But yeah, no, I mean, Joe was a weird guy. I remember there was a time where he used to do this thing where he would like go hunting for like bees, and he would like hit them with a stick. And then, but then what he would do was he would put them in the freezer. Yep. And then once they were frozen, he would tie a string around them, and then he would wait for them to thaw, and then just walk the bees on a little string.
He would.
I don't know why, but he got a lot of amusement out of walking those bees that he hit with a stick.
He used to use dental floss, and he would walk the bees. And then even when they started flying, they were just little kites to them, you know?
Yeah, those poor bees, I don't think they knew what was going on, but... Yeah, I remember, you know, sitting in that house, we wrote a lot of music in that house. And even when like the ceiling was caving in that house, we would use the ceilingless room. Joe and I would sit in there on buckets, and the carpet was torn away, and we're on buckets in this room playing guitar, and I'd be singing. And I remember I wrote a song with him about Jordan called Maggie, Our Lady of the Streets. And Jordan was the guy who was the previous singer of the band, a friend of all of ours. Jordan was such a great guy. Like he was a big dude, boxer. And you know, he was very intimidating, but he was one of the nicest guys you could ever meet. And there was a lot of times where me being like this tiny, kind of skinny, dorky, weird dude, people would try to give me crap. Jordan always stood up for me. He was just a really upstanding guy. And, Joe and I wound up writing a song about him and about like his struggles with addiction. And Joe, kind of he surprised me with how much he brought to the table, because normally Joe is just like, oh, I can play this, but he was really kind of leaning in on it. Like, oh, you should talk about this. Oh, you should talk about this. And it was one of the first songs that we wrote together where he really felt like, I want to make sure that this says what I wanted to say. And he brought just so much to the table, because the whole time, even though me and him, in my mind, I'm thinking I'm writing this song about Jordan, he was also kind of trying to share with me the things that he was also struggling with himself. Joe was a very private person, at least to me. A lot of the things that he struggled with, I didn't know about at all. I didn't know about his family. I didn't know about a lot of the things that he dealt with in the past. I didn't know that he had a lot of demons at that time. So it really started to spill out during this song. But at that point in Denver, you know, I think even though at that time in our lives, I remember waking up every morning and knowing without a shadow of a doubt, like, this is why I'm here on this earth. This is my purpose. Like, I am here to be in this band. And that felt amazing. I mean, these guys were my family. They were my brothers. I mean, you know, you all still are. Every time Sammy and I talk, you know, at the end, he's always like, see you, brother, you know, but it's something we all just mean. It's something that it's not forced. It's just ingrained in us. You know, we're family.
Well, we had each other.
Yeah.
You know, individually, all of us had a separate story.
Yeah.
You know, whether it be our parents who struggled with addiction or, you know, abandonment or, you know, abuse or, you know, everybody had a kind of a tragic story, you know, and we relied on each other because at that time we couldn't rely on our family. We were our family. And yeah, that's a bond that is unbreakable.
Thank you for listening. Please be sure to subscribe, rate, and review the podcast wherever it is that you listen. And don't forget to tune in next week for part two when we hear more about the direction of the band and the way things have played out over the years. Have a great week, everyone.